Ecclesiastes chapter 1. These are the words of the teacher, King David's son, who ruled in Jerusalem. Everything is meaningless, says the teacher, completely meaningless. What do people get for all their hard work under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth never changes. The sun rises and the sun sets, then hurries around to rise again. The wind blows south, then turns north. Around and around it goes, blowing in circles. Rivers run into the sea, but the sea is never full. Then the water returns again to the rivers and flows out again to the sea. Everything is wearisome beyond description. No matter how much we see, we are never satisfied. No matter how much we hear, we are not content. History merely repeats itself. It has all been done before. Nothing under the sun is truly new. Sometimes people say, here's something new, but actually it is old, and nothing is ever truly new. We don't remember what happened in the past, and in future generations, no one will remember what we are doing now. Okay, think about that in terms of the day after the presidential election in the United States. Everything is meaningless. What a way to start out. This guy's trying to teach us something, and he just starts by saying it's all a waste of your time. It's hopeless. It's meaningless. You get the sense of a form of despair from this guy. He doesn't know if there's a reason to live. He's trying to search out the reason for living and what you should live for. And you get the feeling like he's really scratching, clawing, trying to figure out, is there something? Is there something? He's starting out by saying, life is not what you think. Okay, the things that we think we'll find meaning in, those certainly aren't going to be the things that we do find meaning in. Most of the times, the things that we thought would be purposeful for us, satisfying for us, we end up discovering in the end that they're empty, hollow. We try to grab hold of them and keep them, but it's like grabbing after smoke or vapor. That's what this idea of meaningless is. Vanity of vanities is another way that he says it. And the idea of vanity, the idea of meaningless, is like smoke that rises up. It looks solid, but it's not. Just try and grab it in your hand. You can't do it. He's saying that's life. That's the things in life that you think are going to fulfill you. But it's all meaningless. Things like money, relationships, finding some form of success, even your personal health and well-being. He's saying from his life experience, and he'll detail all this, all right? But from his life experience, these things, they don't deliver on the things they promise. Okay? And again, this is the Bible speaking to us. It can sound like the rant of an old man, and you're like, he just didn't have a good life, and that's why he's saying these things. I don't know if I agree with them. Well, that's what the next couple weeks, hopefully, you'll figure out. Do you agree with them? Okay, he says history just goes round and round. You saw the examples he listed here. Generations come and go. They live and die. They do things that are important to them, but then the next generation barely remembers it. Okay. For me, that's the 90s. 90s were awesome. We did a lot of cool stuff in the 90s. Do you guys know what we did in the 90s? Exactly. You don't. You nowadays, you're dressing like you're from the 90s because it goes round and around and around. Human generations come and go, and they're just forgotten. Only very few people are remembered for the important things they did in this world, the mark they left on this world. Very few people. He mentioned the earth goes round the sun every year. Is it once a year? Yeah. The earth goes round the sun, and then it goes round again. And it's like, okay, how far do we make it this year? 0.0 miles. We were back in the exact same place as we were a year ago. He says even though the water that comes to earth, it comes down from the sky in the rain, it makes its way into the ground, into the rivers, flows out into the ocean, and then it just evaporates up out of the ocean, back into the clouds, and comes down out of the sky and fills the rivers again. It's just cyclical. It works in these circles. And he's like, well, what's the point of it all then? Why not just have the water stay in the one spot? Why not just have the earth stay in the one spot? it's not just the cyclical nature of things, history repeating itself. It's that human beings, even if we had it different, were really hard to satisfy. The human heart is insatiable. It's greedy, it's covetous, it's ravenous. None of us will ever have enough of what we want. Being content as a human being is a really difficult thing. All of us will always want more once we have what we think we wanted. Almost always we'll want more. I'm standing over there eating biscuits after dinner, okay? I've already had a couple, you know, and I just wanted one more, you know. And there's basically no calories in biscuits, and so it was fine. But I just wanted more. Right now we have one cat. Guess how many cats is enough for us? Well, it was one until a second one showed up outside. Now we kind of sort of want another cat. We're feeding it. We're trying to get it to come, let us pet it. The human heart is insatiable, and it's a moving target. That's the problem. Whatever we want or we think we want, it comes into our life or it doesn't. But if it does, well, is that enough? You know yourself better than I know you. But not all of us know ourselves in this regard either. But I promise you, that's going to be one consistent thing that happens to you in this life. You think, okay, if I had this thing right here, if I had this much of it, then I'd be happy. Then I'd be satisfied. Well, just wait until you get that thing. Wait until you get that much of it. So history repeats, the human heart, the human being is just unable to be satisfied. We'll never have enough. We'll always want more. In our paragraph here, it said, no matter how much we see, no matter how much we hear, it's not enough. Okay, and there's nothing on this earth that will satisfy us. And that's the point. And here's the thing, that's a true statement. Nothing will satisfy us on this earth. And the question for you is, do you believe that? Assuming there's no God, assuming you're thinking, okay, something from this world, something from the earth, humanly speaking, can satisfy me? Do you agree that apart from God, that's impossible? Or you think you're going to find the thing that will satisfy you? You know, some of you are too young. You haven't experienced enough of life to find out this is true, but you will. Some of you are too busy. You're keeping yourself distracted from the reality of what's being presented here. You're just staying so busy that it's perpetual motion and you'll never stop to answer this question. Some of you are too proud and you think you know better. And again, this is not my perspective. This is Ecclesiastes, a guy from history, a guy from the Bible, speaking God's word. But you think you know better. And so you'll try. You'll try to find meaning in something. And I'll just say good luck, okay? Go do that thing and see if it doesn't come true, that it falls empty. Everyone tries to find meaning. Apart from God, there is none. Okay, and everything we try to find this meaning in, it's going to come back empty. Okay, and that's this meaningless idea. Let's move on in verse 12. It says, I, the teacher, was king of Israel, and I lived in Jerusalem. And by the way, this is why we think it was King Solomon. He's the son of David. That's true of Solomon. He was the king in Israel. He's going to go on to talk about he was the richest person ever. He's got many wives. He's describing what seems to be Solomon. Verse 13, I devoted myself to search for understanding and to explore by wisdom everything being done under heaven. I soon discovered that God has dealt a tragic existence to the human race. I observed everything going on under the sun, and really, it is all meaningless, like chasing the wind. What is wrong cannot be made right, and what is missing cannot be recovered. I said to myself, look, I am wiser than any of the kings who ruled in Jerusalem before me. I have greater knowledge, I have greater wisdom than any of them. So I set out to learn everything from wisdom to madness and folly. But I learned firsthand that pursuing all this is like chasing the wind. The greater my wisdom, the greater my grief. To increase knowledge only increases sorrow. All right, so this is his statement of purpose. This is where the whole story's going. And if you've looked ahead yet, there's 12 chapters in the book of Ecclesiastes. I should have started with this. How many people have read this before? Okay, you're in for a wild ride, okay? He's giving his statement of purpose here. He made it his life purpose to discover the meaning of life. That's what he's going after. This is what he's trying to find. So the starting point is, I made it my main effort in life to study wisdom, to study foolishness, and to see if I couldn't sort it all out. That's what he's doing. Okay, so he tries to learn what good and evil is. He tries to learn what wisdom and foolishness is. And this is a common search. Whether you put this out there as like this direct objective of yours, all of us try to find the meaning of life. Okay, there's a lot of good movies about somebody trying to find the ultimate meaning in life, isn't there? A lot of good stories where that's the goal. Almost always people learn that in the end what they found wasn't like some fact or knowledge, like something that really unlocked the mystery for them, but sort of a state of inner peace, contentment. And I think all those stories would get it wrong. I don't think any of those stories, although they're good stories, and all they do hit you, they match you to what your inner searching is. I don't think they get it right, but they do get it right that people are searching this out. And that's what Solomon's doing here for us. My question for you is, what have you tried searching for? Where has your search taken you when it's come to finding true meaning in life? What have you tried? Up till this point in your life, where have you looked? Are you getting close? Is this something that's kind of right there on your forefront? You think you might be on the verge of finding the meaning of life through seeking this out? What have you tried before? He's going to go on and list all these things that he tried and see if it doesn't match to some of the things that you tried. See if it doesn't match the ways in which you've tried to make a meaningful life. Okay. Where have you tried? Let's get into chapter 2. I said to myself, come, let's try pleasure. Let's look for the good things in life. But I found that this too was meaningless. So I said, laughter is silly. What good does it do to seek pleasure? After much thought, I decided to cheer myself with wine. And while still seeking wisdom, I clutched at foolishness. In this way, I tried to experience the only happiness most people find during their brief life in this world. I also tried to find meaning by building huge homes for myself and by planting beautiful vineyards. I made gardens and parks, filling them with all kinds of fruit trees. I built reservoirs to collect the water to irrigate my many flourishing groves. I bought slaves, both men and women, and others were born into my household. I also owned large herds and flocks, more than any of the kings who lived in Jerusalem before me. I collected great sums of silver and gold, treasure of many kings and provinces. I hired wonderful singers, both men and women, and had many beautiful concubines. I had everything a man could desire. So I became greater than all who lived in Jerusalem before me, and my wisdom never failed me. Anything I wanted, I would take. I denied myself no pleasure. I even found great pleasure in hard work, a reward for all my labors. But as I looked at everything I had worked so hard to accomplish, it was all so meaningless, like chasing the wind. There was nothing really worthwhile anywhere. Now, his first point of effort here, the first thing that he tries, is probably the same place you and I would start. Let's just look for something fun. Let's just try to find something that I enjoy, something that I can find some satisfying pleasure in. Okay, he says he seeks pleasure. That's his starting point. He denied himself no pleasure. We would call this self-indulgence if you're thinking it was selfish, or we would say he's just being a young man, trying to enjoy the youthful years of his life. Okay, but he says he tried it all. And these aren't intellectual pursuits, are they? This is going to parties. This is dating a lot of girls. This is going to the casino and making a bunch of money gambling. This is, and there's some other things in there that seem more responsible. Building houses, built parks, apparently, which is kind of cool. Apparently he was into gardening, running businesses, and all the rest. But he's not talking about like the mental factors. He's talking about the life experience. Lived out. He starts with fancy things. Okay, so he's looking for the good things in life. You know, lobster in your omelet? Anybody? You know, champagne for breakfast? He's talking about the finer things in life, the most expensive things, thinking there's some form of satisfaction and being able to afford the best things in life. Next, he gives himself over to wine. And their different translations have a different statement of what he says. Some say, like, I tried wine, but I never lost my head about it, as if, like, he tried to enjoy the wine. And some make it sound like he drank a lot of the wine and foolishness overtook him. Okay, now we'll leave it to you to decide what you believe, what you agree with. But certainly that's a path that's well worn out, isn't it? The path, I mean, that's the path of UW Stout, isn't it? I went to South Dakota State in Brookings, South Dakota. I think we were the Jackrabbits. I even played sports there, so I should know this. That's what everybody did. What are you doing this weekend? What are you doing on Thursday night? It's like, well, if you didn't go into credit card debt buying, you know, boxes of alcohol, you weren't doing it right. This is a well-worn path, especially for people 18 to 20 to 25, underage or overage, whatever the case is. This is a well-worn out path, and it's fun for the time. And yet a lot of people run into some serious issues from this, the foolishness and debauchery that comes from it. Okay, a lot of people get themselves into problems here. I think that's what he's talking about. Okay, a lot of regret, a lot of pain, a lot of bad choices. Okay, he builds houses, he creates parks and creates beauty, and he runs businesses. He gets really, really wealthy. That's one everybody thinks is going to do it for him. I'm going to make a lot of money, and that's going to make my life meaningful. Then I'll be okay, because then I'll be stable. I'll be set up for anything good or bad that comes. I'll be able to afford the things that I want. Everybody thinks money is going to be the thing that makes their life meaningful. You know how I know this? Because when I ask a person what their major is, what they're studying, and I'm talking to you students right now, it always comes along with the whatever the major is and the follow-up explanation for the job prospects that come with it. Okay, a lot of people like what they're going to do, but at the back end of their college degree is, there's a job waiting for me that's going to pay the bills. It'll either be enough for me, or it'll be really good, and I'm really excited about that. Even people that are beyond college age, you get a job, and you're looking at whether or not you should stay in your current job, and one of the major factors is it pay well enough? Is my current job enough? What if another company values my services more than my current employer? Then what do? Money motivates everybody. Money's something that people chase after in a way that basically that becomes a thing that's leading them through life. Okay. Famous episode of The Office. Dwight, one of the main characters, he quits the job at the office, you know, the title of the show, and he's going to go somewhere that values his loyalty the most. Okay. And really, it's ironic. He's saying, I'm going to be loyal to whoever pays me the most. That's not loyalty. That's the opposite of loyalty, is to stay despite other opportunities. Money's a huge motivator for people. And most people think once they have enough, then I'll be satisfied. This is the richest guy in the entire world. Solomon was, I mean, he had Elon Musk beat hands down. It wasn't even close. Okay, if they had rockets back then, he would have been building rockets. Okay, but instead he was building parks. Lastly, he's talking about all these relationships that he had. Okay, there's a word in verse 8. He talked about hiring wonderful singers, both men and women, and he had many beautiful concubines. You know what concubines are? It's an old word, not one that we use. This would be mistresses. Basically, wives that aren't full wives. They're his mistresses that he would sleep with whenever he wanted. Okay, and he was the king, and so it was even worse. Wasn't just like he'd go have an affair with a woman and then another. He had a harem of women that lived in his palace that he would call upon for his wants and needs. Okay? This guy slept with thousands of women. That's the bottom line. Okay? And in the end, he said, sex was not something that satisfied me the way I thought it would. People are motivated by sex, aren't they? They think, well, once I start having it, then my life will be complete. There's a modern thought that if you're not, if you're a young person and you're not fulfilling your fleshly lusts or your fleshly desires, that there's something wrong with you? Okay, ask me how I know that. Ask me. Because most people are embarrassed to tell people when they're a virgin. There's like this expectation that you should be having sex. You should have a steady boyfriend or girlfriend, or at least be, confident and capable enough to get people of the other gender interested in you. And that ultimately culminates in having a sexual relationship, whether you're married or not. That's our modern culture. Okay, the Bible is extreme to the other side. Okay, the Bible says once you slept with a person, you basically married them. But he's saying sex doesn't satisfy the way you think it's gonna. It's a beautiful part of a marriage that God has given to us, and it's awesome. And it's not like you should hate sex or fear sex or say, no, don't talk about it. We can talk about it. I'm literally on the radio right now talking about it, okay? A Christian radio station. But he's saying it's not the meaning of life. It's not going to satisfy you to have physically intimate relationship. It's not going to ultimately satisfy you in the way you think it's gonna. Okay? And he had more experience probably than anybody ever. Yeah, he says he was greater than anyone who came before him. I don't think he's bragging here. He's the king. You know, he's kind of just being realistic. He said, I could do anything I wanted. I could have anyone I wanted. He even says I could solve anything I needed to solve. I was that smart. Okay, that might be bragging. But he says, none of it satisfied me. Nobody's had a life like this. None of us in this room will come close to touching the variety of experience and the extremes. None of us have these freedoms, if we could call them that, to do anything we want, whenever we want. None of us will. And he says, I had that, and it didn't satisfy me. He even says it's fun, but it didn't satisfy me. Because there was nothing to be gained, not ultimately. There's nothing that to be gained in the end. These things came and went, and then they vanished. Then they were a memory. And then they were just something I thought about if I got bored one day. Okay, there were temporary success and temporary enjoyment, but something was still missing. Okay, something is still missing. Let's go on to verse 12. So I decided to compare wisdom with foolishness and madness, for who can do this better than I, the king? I thought wisdom is better than foolishness, just as light is better than darkness. For the wise can see where they are going, but the fool walks in the dark. Yet I saw that the wise and the foolish share the same fate. Both will die. So I said to myself, since I will end up the same as the fool, what's the value of all my wisdom? This is all so meaningless. For the wise and the foolish both die. The wise will not be remembered any longer than the fool. In the days to come, both will be forgotten. So I came to hate life, because everything done here under the sun is so troubling. Everything is meaningless, like chasing the wind. I came to hate all my hard work here on earth, for I must leave to others everything I have earned, and who can tell whether my successor will be wise or foolish? Yet they will control everything I have gained by my skill and hard work under the sun. How meaningless. So I gave up in despair, questioning the value of all my hard work in this world. Some people work wisely with knowledge and skill, then must leave the fruit of their efforts to someone who hasn't worked for it. This too is meaningless, a great tragedy. So what do people get in this life for all their hard work and anxiety? Their days of labor are filled with pain and grief. Even at night, their minds cannot rest. It is all meaningless. So I decided there is nothing better than to enjoy food and drink and to find satisfaction in work. Then I realized that these pleasures also are from the hand of God. For who can eat or enjoy anything apart from Him? God gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy to those who please Him. But if a sinner becomes wealthy, God takes the wealth away and gives it to those who please Him. This too is meaningless, like chasing the wind. You get a sense that there's this frustration growing in him. And remember, he's an old guy recounting his youth and all the things he tried. But you get the sense that there was frustration back then, and he was trying to learn from it, trying to sort through it. And he had all this frustration. Okay, well, why should I work hard? Okay, one day I'm going to die. I can't take any of it with me, whatever I accumulate and accomplish. And then some idiot's going to come along and inherit whatever I did. So what's the point? But by the way, King Solomon, if that's the one who wrote this, you know what happened when he died to the kingdom of Israel? His son takes over the kingdom, and on day one, he does such a terrible job that the kingdom divides in half, north and south. And then they end up being rivals, and eventually the northern half just stops following God all along. That becomes Samaria, by the way. So his saying here is kind of true, isn't it? Personally to him. His kid, Rehoboam is his name. Rehoboam, I don't know how you pronounce that. He just totally botches it. Solomon built this amazing kingdom, and his son takes over. He gets some bad advice. He has some bad motives, and he just totally bombs it. So everything Solomon worked for just starts to crumple from there. Okay. So what's the point of trying to accomplish anything if whatever you do accomplish, it's really not going to amount to anything in the end? Somebody else is going to take it over. They'll do something different than you originally intended. They'll spend the money that you saved different than you would have wanted, or even on things that you stand against. What's the point of trying to accomplish things in life if you just got to pass them on to somebody else who's just going to basically ruin them for you, spoil your reputation? Think about that with denominations of Christianity. There's these great old Christians that started certain denominations in America, became seeking religious freedom. There's John Wesley comes to mind. And these people were faithful to the Bible. They were faithful to God. They built churches. All kinds of people became Christians and honored the Lord and served the Lord. And nowadays, if those people that started those churches were alive, they would be raising holy hell against what those denominations stand for today. Just totally ruined. Totally against the Word of God now. Totally opposed to the truth of the Bible. Totally taking on the modern thought processes. That's the kind of thing we're talking about here. Okay, so what's the point? And so he's expressing his frustration here. Also, does it matter if I'm good or bad? Does it matter if I live a good life or a bad life? Does it even matter if I live responsibly or just be a fool all the time? Okay, he says the wise and the foolish share the same fate. They both die. They'll both be forgotten just as easily, just as quickly. What's the point of being good if it really doesn't gain you anything in the end? Okay, now you could argue, well, you'd have a better life that way. Okay. What's the point of being good? It'd be much more fun to be irresponsible. It'd be a lot easier to be irresponsible. He says he grew to hate all this. Okay, that's how bad his frustration got. It's like, I can't figure any of this out. Nothing seems like it's right. Nothing seems to be doing it for me. So he says he decides to just enjoy whatever he can. That's verse 24. I said nothing is better than to enjoy food and drink and to find satisfaction in work. Okay. Nothing greater seems like it's going to be anything. So let's just go back to the simple pleasures of life. People do this, by the way, don't they? A lot of people like to think like, okay, I tried all this complexity in life. I'm just going to simplify down. Things will calm down for me. That'll make me happy and content. Okay. In and of itself, it doesn't. But yet, there's hope in that, right? So it's kind of following the same cycle as Solomon. Okay, at this point in time, he introduces God into our story. Yeah, it's verse 25. But then I realize that even these things come from God. Okay, eating, drinking, and working. He says nothing is done apart from him. And whether or not Solomon was taking the approach of, okay, these things come from God, therefore I need to pay more attention to them as the being better, or whether he's just saying nothing can be separated from God, and I just need to be thankful in a way that honors God, in a way that pleases God, in a way that actually means something both to me and to God. I'd say there's a difference only in that, in one sense, you're just saying, okay, I believe it. In another sense, you're thankful for it. Believing that God gives good things is one thing, but actually appreciating the God who does that is a totally different thing. He says, nothing can be separated from God. Everything is a gift from God. But he goes on to talk about the difference between wise and the foolish, and he introduces the word sinner into the mix. And we're not just talking about people that are smart and people who aren't. We're not talking about people who achieve good accomplishments, make their mark on the world, and people who just waste their time with fun. We're talking about holiness here, where we're talking about somebody who actually wants to live a life in the fear of God versus one who doesn't. One who wants to acknowledge God in all their ways and trust God to let things out as they go, or one who just is going to live for all these pleasures of the world. In a way, he's saying, before, when I thought I was being wise and trying all this stuff, I was actually being a fool. I was trying to do it apart from God. Maybe I knew it was from God, maybe I didn't, but I certainly wasn't thankful. When Ecclesiastes introduces God into the story, he doesn't ever talk about him the way that we would talk about Jesus, as in a close relationship with a God who loves us, cares about us, directs our steps. He's almost always talking about God as a far away God you need to fear and respect and honor and observe. And he's not talking too much about the relationship. So when he brings God into the picture, I think we need to pay attention. And yet we don't define our relationship with God based on the statements that he's making. We need to draw further conclusions than just what he says. This is what I mean when we say he's going to make us think. He's going to say things and you're going to have to think, do I agree with that? Is that right? A lot of people would say Ecclesiastes doesn't match with the rest of the Bible. Contradicts the Bible. And there's all sorts of weird stuff in here. And so maybe you let thought will cross your mind as we go. It's not the details, the facts contradict the rest of the Bible. It's not the specifics, the teaching contradicts the Bible. It's the method. It's just different. And so when he provokes us to thought, we have to take it as this is God's word. God is still all he is in the rest of the Bible. Ecclesiastes is not contradicting that. And so we have to figure out how and why and what this would mean to tell us. Well, why is he saying this? What's he trying to say? And in this last instance, verses 24 through 26, I think he's just trying to say, man, it's frustrating, and I found nothing, and therefore, I think I just got to start turning back to God. I think I need to, as a baseline, give God some of my attention, make sure I'm thankful toward him, because everything else is meaningless. Everything else is foolishness, and even outright sinfulness is what he's implying here. We're not going to start chapter 3, so we'll actually end a little early tonight. We'll pick this up, either do one of two things for me. We'll pick this up next week. Leave this here and grab a new copy next week, or take it home and you can read ahead. And we'll try to cover the next couple chapters. Let me pray and then we'll close things down.